This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
Dr. Pete Meyer was the featured speaker for James River Green Building Council's luncheon on February 11, 2014. Meyer briefed the audience on his research into the effects of endocrine-disrupting chemicals and his hope that emerging science will lead to healthier lives. Charlottesville Tomorrow's recording starts with Ned Ormsby of the James River Green Building Council introducing the speaker, Dr. Pete Meyer.
Hello, welcome everybody. This is a good sign that we're all talking and networking. This is what this is all about. Excited to make connections here. I want to jump right into the program. Very excited about today's program. Just the turnout today is kind of an indication that everybody in this room is excited about the presentation today. And that speaks to Pete Meyer's the depth that he goes into his research and the impact he's had on the community. One of the things that we have tried to do at the James River Green Building Council is make that connection with the people of Charlottesville, between the people of Charlottesville and some of the amazing resources we have in this community. There are amazing resources at UVA, at the Darden School, in local architects, builders, environmental policy, people doing environmental policy in Charlottesville. And the goal of the James River Green Building Council luncheon is really to bring everybody together, inspire people, and really promote green building as much as we can. None of this would be possible without the sponsorship, without our luncheon sponsors. They help rent the room and provide lunch for you. Lithic Construction, I'm a project manager for Lithic Construction. 2RW is an engineering firm in Charlottesville that does LEED, MEP design. Allied Concrete is one of our sponsors. RVA Construction out of Richmond. We do a lot of LEED projects down in Richmond. The City of Charlottesville and LEAP, the Local Energy Alliance, are co-sponsors. Terry is here with the Better Business Challenge and is really involved with LEAP. We like to promote these organizations as much as possible. Nature Neutral Green Building Products is also one of our sponsors as well. Coming up, we have a really exciting 2014. Next month, March 11th, Andrea Larson will be talking on creating sustainable business. So we're very excited about that. Another UVA professor, Will Jenkins, will be speaking in May on the connection between religion and the environment. That should be a really inspiring talk. Oculus will be talking. Oculus is a landscape architecture firm in Charlottesville. They'll be presenting. In August, we will be going to the New Fontaine Fire Station to do our luncheon actually at the fire station. 2RW was the engineer, and the county is going to be doing a little presentation on that building. I believe it's LEED Platinum. Just waiting to get confirmation on that. So a lot of exciting programs coming up. But the reason we're all here is to listen to Pete Meyer's present. Pete is he's a leading expert on endocrine disruptors, and he's founder and CEO and chief scientist for Environmental Health Sciences in Charlottesville. He's the publisher of Environmental Health News. And I guess just without further ado, I'll turn it over to Pete.
Great. Thank you. I'll make a promise that's the darkest slide you'll see today, I hope. I apologize. I didn't realize there'd be all this light coming in. Thank you so much for being here. I leapt at the opportunity to talk to members of the James River Green Building Council because when I first came to Charlottesville in 1990, I had a board that had two architects on it. I was a director of the W. Alton Jones Foundation. One of those architects is here in the room, Bill Edgerton, And I was a biologist. I come out of a research background in biology focused on biodiversity and other things like this. I had never thought about the importance of the built environment for human health. Never, not once, not one second. But I spent a dozen years with Bill and with Diane Miller, and for a while Bill McDonough was on the board, and I went to meetings with Bill, of the various architects engaged nationally and internationally on these issues, and I really began to understand that you guys have leverage. You're building the environment that we're going to be living in. You're making decisions that are going to last 50 years, 100 years, and you need to understand some of the science that I do. And that's why I'm here. I hope to, I am a scientist, I'm not a green builder, I'm not an architect, but I think that some of the things I work on are relevant to the decisions that you make every day. And I won't be able to answer all of your questions, but please, if this talk raises issues for you and you want to talk to me later, I'm happy to share my contact information because I really want to help, because the built environment and how you design it is so important for human health. So, that dark slide is supposed to remind us that most sentient beings in the world are aware that there's a problem in the atmosphere with carbon. It's a big problem. And a lot of architectural work has gone to attempting to contribute to solutions to that, to reduce the carbon footprint of buildings. There's another problem in the world that many fewer people are aware of, and that's in the inner world. Thank you. So that is a young fetus in the womb, and every fetus in the world is exposed to environmental chemicals that get to it via multiple pathways and alter the course of development that it takes. I'm not exaggerating when I say every fetus in the world. And the key thing that I want you to remember in this, two things. First, the most important event in this process of development is when genes, symbolized by those chromosomes and that light in that chromosome, when genes are being turned on and off. That has to happen at the right time for development to proceed in a way that produces a healthy baby, a healthy infant, a healthy adolescent, and ultimately a healthy adult. When things interfere with that process is when things go wrong. And I'm going to be talking about that. But the other important thing I want you to remember is the science over the last 20 years on these issues has progressed so far and so fast. We now are in a position to act on that science and help people be healthier. That's my focus, is helping people be healthier by using this emerging science so that the right decisions are being made, so that as we move forward, we contribute to the health of the next generation. So, some of the stuff I'm going to tell you about is a little troubling, but bear that endpoint in mind. We can make people healthier by using this science. So, most of us, many of us, if all we had is high school biology or even a little bit of college biology 50 years ago, 20 years ago, we think about genes as those little entities we inherit from our parents, right? It turns out that genes are nature's nanotechnology. They are being turned on and off trillions of times a second throughout your life. And the forces that are sufficient to turn a gene on or prevent it from turning on when you need it, they can be minuscule. Low doses of chemicals can really make a difference. So we used to think that, in classic genetic terms, that we're really vulnerable. It's fate whether or not we get the right genes. Did we get the right gene from my, inherit the right gene from my parents? Or not? And if any of you every once in a while hear a result from the Human Genome Project where they're sequencing everyone's genes and trying to figure out how those are linked to the disease, and so there'll be another story about how schizophrenia is linked to a gene or diabetes is linked to a gene, most of us, using that old framework of heredity is the determining factor, most of us think, oh, damn, did I get the wrong gene? And if I didn't, everything's hunky-dory. But if I did, it's a fatalistic problem. What I'm here to talk about is the fact that environmental factors, things like diet, stress, experience, and environmental contaminants can collectively alter how genes are being turned on and off. The term of art is gene expression. That's how geneticists talk about it. So are the genes being expressed in the way that leads to health? So many of us grew up at a time when there was this dichotomy. Is it genetics or is it environment? Nature versus nurture. This whole new science that's evolved over the last 30 years has really flipped that on its head. Yes, we do inherit genes from our parents, and sometimes they are flawed. Most of the time, they're not. But instead, what happens is environmental factors like diet, experience, stress, contamination, they interact with the genes, they alter gene expression, and that's the determining factor for health. So this is a way to look at the interaction between genes and environment in a way that shifts us from this fatalistic notion, did I get the right gene or not, to one where actually when I hear a new result from the Human Genome Project, I start asking what could possibly be interfering with that gene and can we do something about it? Because the science is telling us that's the likely thing that's happening and we know now enough to begin asking, can we alter the factors that are influencing that gene's expression? So, yeah.
What does experience refer to?
Just one simple example. Do you exercise?
Yes.
So you go to the gym, your muscles build? Well, they're building because the experience is telling that tissue it needs more muscle. So it's changing gene expression in the tissues responsible for creating muscle. It's a very simple example. Another example, much more interesting, and I'll refer to mice and rats multiple times today. Excuse me if you're eating lunch, but I'm not. So if a mother rat is prevented from licking her pups before they are weaned, that pup grows up without being able to produce the right amounts of two hormones in adulthood that are crucial for bonding. Okay? So that's another very simple example of how experience, in this case being licked by a grooming mother, alters gene expression much later in life with profound consequences. And there's actually, I won't go into this today, but there's a lot of human work that follows up on that very type of process. Okay? So we live in a world in which there are multiple modern epidemics. Let me ask a couple of questions here, and put your hands up if the answer is yes. I want you to think about your families, people close to you, your friends. And if, for example, how many of you within that circle of friends have colleagues, family members who've experienced breast cancer? How about learning disabilities? How about type 2 diabetes? How about autoimmune diseases? I could keep going on. The list of this suite of modern epidemics is quite long. I want to ask one final question. How many of you, or put your hand up at least once? Okay. This does not have to be. Some of these, the burden of each of these the diseases that I've just mentioned are likely to be caused by exposures to environmental chemicals in the womb. The science is uncertain in all of them, because science is always uncertain. But for many of them, we know enough now, I think, to justify interventions, designing better materials, preventing exposure, et cetera. And that means that we don't, in 30 years, if we act on this science, not as many of you are going to put your hands up. We can lead to a healthier generation of people. Does that make sense? So just give you one simple example of the sort of effect that scientists have noted as a result of exposure in the womb to chemicals. These are drawings made by an anthropologist studying children in a valley in Mexico, where the village responding to the Green Revolution split into two groups. Some of them stayed in the valley, which was covered by agricultural fields. Another part of the village moved up into the hills above the agricultural matrix. And this shows what happens when the anthropologist asks four-year-old kids to draw a picture of a person. The kids living in the hillsides respond normally to that question, the pictures on your right. The kids living in the midst of heavy agricultural pesticide use were incapable of rendering a picture that looked at all like what a normal child would be able to produce. So, we used to think that if a disease is linked to a gene, it's under hereditary control. That was the fatalistic framework. We now know that sometimes that's the case, but it's actually a minority of cases. We now know that diseases linked to genes, that link can be through changes in gene expression caused by environmental factors. And as I will develop shortly, this can happen at really low doses. So here we have a guy spraying in the fields, probably with very little training, ultimately leads to one form of exposure, which is through the food chain. There are lots of sources of exposure to chemicals that disrupt hormones. They're in all of our electronics. Often they're put there to minimize the chances that the computer will catch on fire. They're flame retardants. How many of you picked up a paper receipt today from the ATM machine? They are coated with one of several compounds, most of them with something called bisphenol A, BPA, which is a very potent endocrine disrupting compound. And every time you handle one, you transfer BPA dust to your fingers. I cringe every time I'm in BODOs and I see someone trying to struggle with balancing the bagel and everything and then putting the receipt in their mouth. They just got a whopping dose of BPA. Yeah?
Was that chemical report?
What does it do?
On the paper.
On the paper. It turns out that, it's a great question, it turns out that the printer that you see, that it's coming out of, the paper's coming out, it doesn't have ink in it. Instead, embedded in the paper are microcapsules of dye, which when it stays within the capsule, the dye is clear. But then these hot pins that are in the printer, they break the microcapsules, and that releases the dye, which combines with BPA dust, which is on the surface. That's what, and the BPA combined with the dye changes the dye to dark. That's how those printers work. I was talking about this at a college a couple years ago, and a student asks me, Dr. Myers, sometimes I burn those papers. Is that okay? And I'm thinking, I don't want to alarm him, but look, just don't breathe it in. And another student says, he rolls his joints with those. I mean, it's a good illustration of the fact that you cannot anticipate what human creativity will do with materials. Okay, I heard the head of sustainability for Hewlett-Packard, HP, in a lecture a year or so ago say, I can't tell your kid not to chew on the power cord. So we're getting hazardous materials out of the power cord, even though when it's used for its intended use, it's safe. Okay, so you can't count on things to be used for intended use. When we get on sofas, very often they're made with a whole lot of flame retardant in them, brominated flame retardants. They're good at slowing fires, but they are neurotoxicological toxins. They do bad things to the developing brain of babies. A lot of the clothing that Gore-Tex makes is made using a process that puts perfluorinated compounds in them. These are incredibly persistent, and they interfere with a whole series of metabolic processes. We have food chain problems. Farm salmon is fed chow created by grinding up fish, and that accumulates persistent organic pollutants like PCBs and dioxins, so that the farmed salmon has been shown to be higher concentrations of some of these very persistent compounds than wild salmon. Pesticides get into wine. You can go to Whole Foods and buy organic pesticides, which at least reduce that. There's a whole story I could spend the entire day talking about what are called food additive contaminants, and how the types of things we put food in, plastics, metal, whatever, and how much of that can leach into the food, and how little attention is paid to that source of contamination because of loopholes in the FDA's rules. Cosmetics contain problematic materials, pesticides do. And then the materials that you all work with. Plywoods contain formaldehyde. Most plywoods will contain formaldehyde. There's some good naturally based solutions to that that are entering into the market. Bill probably knows all about those. Vinyl flooring, there's incredible work, but actually scientifically credible work coming out of Sweden showing that the dust that's created by traffic over vinyl flooring contains phthalates, and those phthalates increase the risk of asthma in children who grew up in those bedrooms with vinyl flooring. And I suspect most of you in the building world know about one additional example, which is you can't see the picture very well, the Chinese drywall syndrome that hit a few years ago, where because Chinese drywall makers sourced some of their raw materials from places that were high in sulfur, you wound up with not just stinky rooms, but rooms risky for health. And it cost the building industry a lot of money to replace those, and homeowners. So some of you will know this resource. This is a great place run by the Healthy Building Network, Pharos. It's a website. And these people pay attention to the science, and they try and present it in a way that makes it accessible to people in the business. I highly recommend them as a source of information and guidance. The science I focus on is called endocrine disruption. It's when chemicals interfere with how genes are being turned on and off, especially during fetal development. Why do I worry about this? Well, exposure to endocrine disrupting compounds is ubiquitous. There's not a living organism on the planet in whom we cannot measure one or more endocrine disrupting compounds. The doses at which these can be effective at affecting, at derailing proper development are incredibly low. But remember that positive news. We now know enough about this phenomenon and enough about the science to begin reducing the exposures and creating materials that are inherently safer. Now, I want to show you just one example of how endocrine disruption works using stick diagrams out of molecular genetics. So here's a cell, the exterior fluid, and the nucleus. And this represents a strand of DNA. And this is a hormone receptor that's in the cell. And this is a hormone, in this case called glucocorticoid, that's going to move into the cell, bind with receptor, and then that bound complex is going to go into the nucleus, bind to a site on the gene where it turns the gene on, and that gene then produces a protein that in this case is really important for you defending yourself against tumors. Glucocorticoid does lots of different things. One of the things it does is help our immune system prepare itself for dealing with tumors. So if this isn't working, you got a problem. Okay. So some of you may have been reading recently about the the Duke Coal Company spill in the Dan River, where they're saying, oh my gosh, there's arsenic in that coal slurry. But it's not a problem. Well, let me show you with this stick diagram what happens at under 10 parts per billion arsenic when that interacts with the glucocorticoid receptor. So here you have the glucocorticoid hormone entering the cell again, binding with the receptor. Arsenic goes over and binds with that complex, and it then prevents the gene from being turned on. So at really low levels, arsenic isn't overtly toxic. It's not killing you because it's poisonous. It's increasing the chances you're going to have a tumor you can't fight at a level which is way beneath the level that traditional toxicology worried about arsenic poisoning. It's not an overt poison at this level. What it's doing is making you less able to resist disease. So this field endocrine disruption began in the 1970s, really, as a scientific issue. And there have been a number of core pillars of it that have emerged in the last 30 years of research. And I only have time to briefly summarize three. One is that low doses matter a lot. It's not a question of high-dose arsenic poisoning. It's a question of low-dose interfering with gene expression. High-dose versus low-dose. Okay. The second one is that events in the womb don't stay in the womb. These things play out over the lifetime of a person. We've just heard in the news last week, a new study published out of Rutgers University, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that people with Alzheimer's have 4 to 5 times higher levels, people with high levels of DDE residues in them.
How much do you have?
I have DDE, and I'm forgetting. Okay. If you look at a spectrum of people, some relatively low dose, some relatively higher dose, none really high dose of DDT now. If you look at that spectrum, the people in the higher dose range are 4 to 5 times more likely to have Alzheimer's. So this is the first ever hint, 50 years after DDT is banned, that it might be contributing to today's epidemic of Alzheimer's. We don't know, and this result, like science is never certain. There may be an astounding series of studies that come out over the next 3 years as people respond to this and begin to dig into it that show why this result was mistaken. But it gives you a sense as to the surprises that lie in wait for us as we move forward with the science. The third key thing is that the tools that we have used, the toxicological methods we have used to assess safety, what's safe and what's not, they've been profoundly misguided at dealing with this sort of toxicity, with endocrine disruption. So let's go to the issue of low doses matter a lot. Here's a picture of two mice. One fat, one not. One morbidly obese, actually. And it's the same strain of mouse. They're adults. They were monitored through their lifetime to this point. They ate the same amount. They didn't move. The fat one didn't move less than the thin one. They're representative of the control group and the experimental group. This is work by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. What happened? Well, the fat mouse was exposed to 1 part per billion at birth to an estrogenic compound, a compound that mimics estrogen. 1 part per billion. We know a lot now about the mechanisms by which this happens. It turns out that chemical is turning on a gene in stem cells. Now, there are the embryonic stem cells, which are the things that simulate all the political fights. We also have what are called, we have pools of stem cells, in this case mesenchymal stem cells in the skin, that are waiting to be applied, to replace tissue. Okay? Our tissue wears out, we have to replace it. This particular pool of stem cells normally becomes a bone cell when it gets the right hormonal signal. In this case, when it's stimulated by this compound, it becomes a fat cell instead of a bone cell. And now we have information suggesting that animals and people exposed to this type of endocrine disrupting compound have poorer bone density and a bigger risk of obesity. This is actually quite well established now. It's called, the term of art is obesogens. Factors that affect how genes are turned on or off in ways that increase the risk of obesity. I'll return to the slide for another point later. So a second example of why low doses matter. I'm sorry, I didn't anticipate all the light there. There, can you see two frogs? Okay, they're mating. Okay, the problem is that they're both male. Not necessarily a problem, but it's not natural for frogs, two male frogs, to mate. What happened? Between the time of hatching and metamorphosis, when it changed from a tadpole to a frog, is this animal was exposed to 2.5 parts per billion of a commonly used herbicide called atrazine. Okay? Not only are they mating, but the genetic male on the bottom is so fully converted that it is capable of laying eggs that can be fertilized. And those fertilized eggs grow up to be fully functional adult frogs. There's a complete sex conversion because of this exposure. Let's put the exposure, 2.5 parts per billion, in perspective. So this is a log scale. That's 0.1 to 1 part per billion, and this is a million, or 110,000 to a million parts per billion. So the further up on here, the bigger the difference is. This result here was obtained at 2.5 parts per billion exposure for that part of the animal's life. If a farmer's using atrazine, they want to get out there about over a million parts per billion to kill weeds. If you begin measuring atrazine in various places downstream from the places where it was applied, you find it, for example, in runoff directly adjacent to the fields at maybe 8,000 parts per billion. In streams further down, it might be 200 parts per billion. EPA's safe level for short-term exposure is 100 parts per billion. Surface water away from the site of application is 80 parts per billion. The EPA considers safe for drinking at 2 parts per billion. You can find it because atrazine, if it's in sunlight, it evaporates and goes into the clouds and combines with the rain in the clouds and it's carried downwind and falls onto the ground. You can find atrazine in rainwater 600 miles downstream from application points at 1 part per billion. So it's a problem. Now, the scientist who did this work, a guy named Tyrone Hayes, is in this week's New Yorker. You pick up the February 10th issue of the New Yorker, and you read about this research and how the company who did the company who produced the compound spent years trying to discredit this scientist. Years, viciously trying to discredit the scientist, investigating his wife, following him around to meetings, whispering to him at meetings. You know, aren't you worried about being away from home so much of the time? This is one of the reasons why there is such confusion in the world at large about these issues. When there's a lot of money at stake, there are a lot of lawyers who play, and sometimes it's very nasty. The New Yorker actually based this story on research that we did, Environmental Health News. We published a report about it in June, where our reporter got a hold of documents that had been sealed in a lawsuit. 23 utility districts in the Midwest sued the manufacturer, Syngenta, because they were being forced to clean up the water to meet EPA standards. And Syngenta settled for $105 million. Part of the ultimate outcome, thankfully, was some of those documents were unsealed, and we were able to get a hold of them and reveal what Syngenta never wanted you to know about what they knew when. It's as ugly as the tobacco wars. And unfortunately, we know this is happening in other of these chemical-related issues, just as it's happening on climate. So Let's go back to the list. Events in the womb don't stay in the womb. Everyone finished lunch? Okay. I mentioned the DDT experiment, or result. That's pretty interesting. But here's an experiment with animals. And this, yes, is the inside of a mouse. Can you see? So male, it's got testes, healthy kidney. The effects are not subtle, so you'll be able to see. And a bladder that looks normal. That's the control mouse. Okay. What would have happened? Oh, and that mouse is about my age in mouse years. Okay. So well after getting out of the womb. If that mouse had been exposed to 20 parts per billion in the womb, and only in the womb, no exposures since then, here's what it would have looked like. The bladder is about to explode. The kidneys, they don't work anymore. They're completely necrotic. This particular experiment, however, had no effect on the testes. So what happened? Think about what connects the bladder to the outside world. It's called the urethra. It's what we all mammals pee through. And there's a section of the urethra in male mice that goes through the prostate. And in that section, there's a small piece of tissue that responded to the BPA, changing how genes were subsequently expressed in response to other natural hormone signals. So that as the animal aged, its urethra ultimately squeezed shut, and it could no longer pee. Okay? So that's one very unsubtle effect of exposure in the womb that, unless you're using really high technology methods to measure as the animal was born, you wouldn't have been able to see anything. It was only as it reached my age in mouse years that you started to see these effects. So how do we get into this mess? Modern chemistry as we know it began in about 1850 in Switzerland in Basel with the discovery of ways to make dyes. Really cool stuff. So you could have purple lace. There's a wonderful book called Tom's River that goes into the history of the chemical industry, written by a famous science journalist named Dan Fagan. I highly recommend the book. So that's where things started. We had the first plastic invented around 1900. PVC, polyvinyl chloride, was patented in around 1915. Then in about 1936, some endocrinologists, people who study hormones, discovered that this molecule that had been around for a while called bisphenol A or BPA, they discovered that it was a synthetic estrogen in 1936. They published it in the scientific peer-reviewed literature. The chemists, 15 years later, who figured out how to take individual molecules of BPA and chain them into polycarbonate plastic, never knew anything at all about the fact that BPA was a synthetic estrogen. I mean, would anyone in their right mind have made baby bottles out of a sex hormone if they knew that's what it was? This is why when you go into Walmart today, every baby bottle is labeled BPA-free because they're not using sex hormones to make baby bottles anymore. We went through an amazing period in the 1950s and 60s, DDT. And other organochlorine pesticides, which subsequently have been banned. Some pharmacological agents were invented, one called diethylstilbestrol, DES, which has a horrific history. Doctors thought they could use it to treat people for difficult pregnancies, and turns out it was causing, in 18-year-old girls who had been exposed in the womb, it caused a very rare cancer. Rare, non-existent in 18-year-old girls. So we went through a series of experiences with these chemicals where no one was asking the right questions about what health consequences there might be. In 1962, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. She actually has a section in her book, which, you, looking at it retrospectively, was about endocrine disruption. It wasn't called that then. in the 1970s, well, 1972, the EPA was brought into being, but that's when plastics really spread wildly, again, without any thought of safety testing. We wrote a book, Theo Colborne, Diane Dumanosky, and I, in 1996, called Our Stolen Future, where we brought this issue to the public for the first time in a major way. It was a bestseller. Sometime, if you're interested, I'll tell you how I got to have tea with the Emperor of Japan because of this book. It was kind of weird being there, but they invited me. Anyway, for me, what this book did, we asked a lot of questions. We were criticized by industry even for asking the questions. But what it did was it stimulated enough public interest that hundreds of millions of dollars were invested into answering the scientific questions that we and other people in the field began to ask them. The chair of the House Subcommittee on Health Appropriations held the book up in front of the then head of NIH and said, "You need to read this book." So lots of money flowed in. And the result has been, since then, tens of thousands of scientific papers published in this field. Tens of thousands of them. And since I have all day today, I'll tell you about every one of them. No. So we knew we had come out of the wilderness last year when the World Health Organization in February of 2013, the World Health Organization published a report on endocrine disrupting compounds in which they concluded that EDCs are a global public health threat. That's WHO. That's not the fringe of science. It took us a long time to get there, but now we're working with world health experts around ways to reduce these exposures. So, the last of these pillars of the science I'll deal with briefly are that the ways we try to ask what's safe and what's not have been misguided, because they haven't been focused principally on the low doses that we now know matter, and also that you often can't detect effects until much later in life. But it's also due, because of the politics of how regulatory toxicology, that whole process works, I'm not exaggerating here, the FDA is using tests for safety that were invented in the middle of the 20th century. They are not capable of incorporating the modern molecular genetics that the people I work with use to explore these adverse effects. I mean, which one of these pictures would you rather find at UVA? Here's a metaphor. You think about the Hubble Space Telescope. How many of you have seen those photographs of the galaxies from the Hubble? I mean, those are amazing. Well, the metaphor is, if you're the FDA and you're trying, and your job is to verify whether or not those photographs are real, you grab your binoculars and go into the backyard. And when you can't see anything, you say, "They're not real." Okay, that's what's happening. That's the dynamic right now. We are working hard to try and help them modernize the science they're using, but they are so far behind right now and conflicted in economic ways to such an extent that they've largely become, at least in this field, they've largely become an agency that's more about protecting the companies than about protecting people. So I showed you this photograph before. It illustrates another core problem of regulatory toxicology, which I could go on at length on, but I just make this point very simply. That experimental mouse, the morbidly obese one, had been exposed to one part per billion of that compound. What do you think would happen if it had been exposed to 1,000 parts per billion? Would it have been kind of like that bladder that was about to explode? Would it be even fatter? Actually, it would be thinner than the control mouse. And there's all sorts of science that lies behind this now. But bottom line, you cannot predict what these low-dose chemicals are going to do by just testing at high doses. But all of regulatory toxicology, all the procedures, all the studies that the FDA does and the EPA does to ask what is safe and what is not, they assume that high-dose testing will reveal low-dose results. Not the case.
Is that a general principle, or is that just an example to show that?
It's a general principle in endocrinology, that what happens at different doses changes qualitatively. There, at a low dose, one suite of genes will be expressed. At an intermediate dose, another suite of genes will be expressed. At high doses, you have overt toxicity. That's why the animals lose weight, because they're being poisoned.
I see.
Okay. Great question. But if you take endocrinology here at UVA, endocrinology 101, you will learn that what I said is true. Endocrinologists understand that the dose response curve is not what they call monotonic. It doesn't always increase or decrease. It has odd shapes, which means a core assumption of regulatory toxicology, which has been in place since the 1600s, is false. Oh, absolutely. And the scientists who do this work are very, very sensitive to that issue. And I can give you lots of references on that.
I find that very curious.
Well, it's a question of doing your experiments and having your controls and your positive controls. And there are ways in that toxicology can deal with this if they want to. And I should say, I work with toxicologists all the time. Really good toxicological scientists doing this sort of work. It's largely the regulatory agencies that are locked into old ways of doing things. So it's old science versus new science, not toxicology versus endocrinology. So I talked about this whole issue of what turns genes on and off, and the term of art is epigenetics and endocrine disruption. I talked about how toxic compounds, we used to think that they win at high doses, like you were just mentioning, because they overwhelm the body's defense systems. They overtly kill. But now we know that at least some compounds interfere with gene expression. They hijack the control of gene expression. And as you intubated, some of these effects are taking place at levels we could not measure 20 years ago. You can experimentally manipulate them and show that they're causing effects, but 20 years ago, you couldn't even measure the doses that are sufficient. Now, what can you do about this? There are really three levels at which we're trying to work. One, we as individuals can make choices about our habits, our lifestyles, and we can make active choices that decrease our exposure to a wide array of chemicals. There's a great book with a funny title. It's actually kind of funny. It's called Slow Death by Rubber Duck. And it was inspired by that rubber duck that, you know, all our kids played with. It's made out of PVC plastic. The reason why they can squeeze it is because it's 35% weight of a phthalate, which is an endocrine disrupting compound. And in the mid-1990s, we won a battle, collectively we, to get the manufacturers to take phthalates out of rubber ducks. Okay. You can ask what the replacement is, and I'll get to that momentarily. But in essence, what these guys did, two guys, went to the mother-in-law's apartment of one of them, locked themselves in for a week, and they consciously tried to... First, they measured what was in their urine, six different compounds. Then they consciously tried to increase it by eating lots of tuna, shampooing with phthalate-containing cosmetics all the time, drinking from polycarbonate bottles, and they were able to show that they could up their exposures to each of these things by consciously choosing things within the range of normal human behavior, but kind of unusual for them because they were conscious of this. So they then did the opposite. They spent several days obsessively avoiding exposures, and they were able to show they could bring themselves way down beneath the level at which they began, even before the work that they did trying to raise them. So, and this was an anecdotal study in a mother-in-law's apartment. This has been replicated in serious science done by Harvard, done by University of Washington. This is all possible and it's doable. But it's not fair that we put this burden on consumers. Moms have a lot of other things they have to worry about than spending their entire time in the grocery store or the drugstore or Kohler's or wherever obsessing, is there phthalates in this material? That's not their job. We should have, I meant to mention, there's a brand new book just out by these guys, Tox In, Tox Out, where they take the experiments to a new level. I don't think it's available in the US yet, they're Canadian. So what we've done is create a system where most of us assume the products have been tested for safety. The reality is the vast majority of the 80,000 or so synthetic chemicals that are novel to human body chemistry that weren't around here in 1900 have never been tested at all. Some of them have been tested to some degree, a small percentage of them. Most of them have not been tested at all. They've been grandfathered in through regulatory decisions made by the FDA, the EPA, and ultimately guided by Congress. What we need to do as a second level of protection is we need to bring these regulations out of the scientific Jurassic, make them reflect modern science. They don't. They can. The science is there. We need to help people understand that it's in their interest to ask their representatives to work to make the law reflect modern science. We also assume right now that there are safe alternatives, or at least safer alternatives. But the problem is that most of the existing alternatives that you, if you're a chemist and you want to replace phthalates, you look in the shelf and say, oh, here's that, and you grab it, and it has the material characteristics that you want to manipulate, achieve the material thing you are trying to do. But most of the time, the stuff we're trying to replace, the bad stuff, we know vastly more about that than we do about the replacement, because no one's ever been motivated to test what the replacement does. So we have this serial history with a whole wide range of chemicals of taking bad stuff out, putting untested stuff in its place, and discovering later that, oops, it's bad, or it's just as bad, or it's worse. Remember the paper receipts? When I first started working on this about 10 years ago, we did some market surveys with a chemist who's a specialist in the process I described as to how the dye combines with the BPA. We did some market surveys asking in the Massachusetts area, which is where he was based, what percentage of receipts are BPA based? And it was about 50%. Great! There's an economically competitive replacement in the market today. We help people understand that BPA is bad. The manufacturer will be driven to get this new stuff in its place and will avoid a major source of exposure. Until we asked, well, what's the replacement? It's BPS. It's the chemical differences between BPA and BPS are trivial, but there were two, as opposed to BPA, there were something like, at the time, maybe 1,500 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on BPA. There were two on BPS. I immediately organized some money for one of the leading toxicologists on BPA to replicate the work and begin asking serious questions about BPS, and it's just as bad as BPA. So here's one of the examples where the existing replacements are either unknown or just as bad. And so one of the great pleasures of my work now is with chemists. I'm trying to help chemists make money by making inherently safer materials, by using the new science that we have in hand to avoid endocrine disruption and other types of toxicity early in the design process before it gets into the marketplace. We have great fun. This is a team that I've been working with for 6 years now. Two of the world's leading, they call themselves green chemists, and a major figure from the National Institute of Environmental Sciences. And to get chemists and biologists to work together, we had to resort to all sorts of trickery. Because they have their languages, their jargon is different, et cetera. In this case, we took them to a retreat We gave them all aprons with their names on them. We pulled the curtains back, and lo and behold, there were three gourmet chefs who spent the next 2 hours teaching them how to make gourmet appetizers together in teams, half biologists and half chemists. We did another event like that. Have any of you know the Bocantico Estate? This is where the Rockefeller brothers grew up in. I bet Bill's been there. I'm sorry that you can't see the photo. That's John D. Rockefeller right there. He's never seen anything like this happening at his estate. These are, again, teams of chemists and biologists carving pumpkins. It was right around Halloween. It was near Sleepy Hollow. We thought it was appropriate. And there's carving pumpkins. One was supposed to be the best representation of endocrine disruption. One was the best illustration of a disease endpoint. And the biologists in here, particularly the reproductive biologists, created things I couldn't show on the screen. Fortunately, you can't see it anyway. Anyway, so we've been doing this for 6 years, helping chemists take advantage of this amazing wealth of sciences that has emerged over the last 20 years and figure out how do we deliver to the moms who want to know there isn't a sex hormone in the bottles, how do we deliver a product that's inherently safer and do it in a way that works for the companies. We've now published this in a big academic study where we are literally underway right now with chemists and biologists doing some field testing as to whether or not this intellectual framework for this works. It's called, scientists always come up with a weird name, it's called a tiered endocrine disruptor protocol, TIPED. It's voluntary, which is key. We threw all the lawyers out of the room. We wouldn't let any lawyers participate in this process because once they get in there, and I'm sorry if there are lawyers here, okay. Once lawyers represented vested interests who want to protect products get in the room, everything grinds to a halt. So the EPA had a mandate to do this beginning in 1996 after our book. They've spent $100 million and still haven't finished. $100 million. And it was because their vested interests throwing stuff in the gears so it couldn't move forward. We can use modern science. We aren't tied to old stuff. It's not about current replacements. It's about helping design new chemicals that are targeting, that are designed to be replacement for specific problematic chemicals. It's economically efficient when you think about it. We're helping companies make decisions before they waste a lot of money and time on something that ultimately they won't be able to use. We help them focus their energies on chemicals that are going to work in the marketplace, that are going to be safe. And it's driven by considerations not just from toxicology, but also from endocrinology. So, and lastly, we're not going to get locked into 1950s tests. We're not going to be at the bleeding edge because people want stuff that they know they can count on, but we're using things that represent modern molecular genetics and other modern sciences. So early on I showed you this list. Some of you may have heard public health experts talking about the reality today that our children are less healthy and they're going to lead less healthy lives than we did. Some of that is being caused by the explosion of chemicals that are altering gene expression, leading to inappropriate developmental endpoints, making people sick. I'm convinced that doesn't have to be. I'm convinced that the range of options I laid out, making the right individual choices, changing the laws, but especially helping chemists and companies get it right from the first place and helping them make money, that's the way to a future of healthier kids. So thank you. I don't know how much time we have, but I'm happy to answer questions. Oh, one last thing. This is our website, Environmental Health News. It has a free daily subscription. I know Ann subscribes to it. It makes her blood pressure go up every morning, she was telling me earlier. It's free, ehn.org. So please.
Are there BPA replacements that are not BPS?
Yes, yes, there are. And there are companies, and some of the ones that are out in the market today, we're learning, have their own problems. But there are also companies that are actively working right now. It's a big market. It's a huge market. And they see if they can satisfy consumers that their product is safer, they're gonna make money.
And labeling is probably coming along to tell us what's in it?
Labeling is an issue. We need better labeling standards than we have. The internet's a wonderful thing for sharing information about false claims. And a lot of that goes on. Yeah?
Has much study been done about reactions to some of the preservatives in food?
So I'm not an expert on preservatives in food. I can point you to some websites that do present information about that, and I would recommend you spend time with them instead of with me on this.
Okay. How many children have so many allergies now? When I was a kid, you might be allergic to peanut butter. It seems like kids now are allergic to half the stuff that's...
The immune system, the development of the immune system is run by hormones. If hormonal signals directing the development of the immune system as you're maturing can lead to serious problems, either hyperactive immune systems, which leads to autoimmunity, or hypoactive, which means you can't resist diseases. So the immune system problems are part of this story. Not all immune system problems are due to this, but almost certainly some are.
Unfortunately, while I'd love to keep Pete here all day, one of my great regrets is that we aren't able to continue for the rest of the day, and I know some people have to leave. I just want to thank Pete for coming out. It was a great presentation.
Great, thank you. Well, thanks for your interest.
If Pete hadn't said it, I would have made the point, please do subscribe to Environmental Health News. I know he's always looking for support, and it's a great publication. One interesting note, in September, Forbo Flooring is coming to speak about full transparency in product declarations. So this really gets to what Pete is talking about, really is integral to everything we do as builders and engineers in making sure the products that we build are as healthy as they can be. So it all ties together. Thank you all for coming out. Thanks, Ned.
That was September?
Yeah.